Hello, young lovers, whoever you are. I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Like you.
And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you
do. Each night we're going to bring you the best and the brightest authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that faces every day right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
That street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own. Ah.
Cheryl Guest Williams is with us. She is the author of Trying to Stay Sane While Raising Your Teen. That's a primer for parents. In addition to writing, she currently teaches technology and math to high school students at Mount Carmel High School, a 105-year-old Catholic institution dedicated to turning boys into men. Having had this position for the last 8 years, not only has she taught classes in male-dominated environments, she has consistently raised the school's awareness of women and African-American people throughout her classes and among her colleagues. She's also taught technology and business courses at several community colleges as well. And Cheryl, hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Trying to stay sane while raising your teen. And in the world today, that's really something that most parents have a problem with, because teenagers today are not what teenagers were 30 and 40 years ago. It's a different culture. It's a different environment. And there is this thing called responsibility and accountability that, for some reason, Cheryl, it doesn't seem to fall into the definition in their language.
No, that's absolutely correct, Michael. Nowadays, not only do you have the accountability and responsibility as issues, you also have the quickness of technology. And so things that young people are interested in today and have access to today are entirely different from even 20 years ago.
I think it took me about 10 or 15 years from the time of a particular incident to understand what a man was and, you know, turning boys into men. I remember once I was in the 11th grade and I was in love. Man, was I in love. This was the woman of my life. There would never be another one. That was about 100 years ago. And we were sitting in the car one night and she was breaking up with me because she had found, and we were in the 11th grade, she found an older man who was a junior in college. And she looked at me. She said, "You'll never be the man he is." First thing in my mind, Cheryl, was, "Oh, well, I could kick his blah, 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 blah," right? And then as I grew, I began to understand what truly a man was. And a man, and it's the same definition for a woman. It's being responsible for your emotions and being responsible for your actions. And when it boils down to it, that's the core.
Oh, that's absolutely correct. And I think nowadays what's happening is that you have a lot of interruptions with things like the internet and with Facebook and those kinds of things. And then you have the suggestiveness of videos and the culture is entirely different and it's very quick. It's sure. Very difficult for parents.
Well, they're exposed to so many things. Yes, they're exposed to so much today. What was it? I was when I grew up. You know, when you went to the movies, there was a law. If there was a bedroom scene in the movies, I mean, we're talking a literal law that one foot had to be on the floor. You know, there are two separate beds. And that goes back to the Doris Day movies and so on and so forth. It's come a long way from there. And how do you tell a teenager how to live a life when they see so much of life that parents don't get exposed to?
Oh, I completely agree. Not to mention the fact that in some cases the parents are a lot younger than when I was growing up. And so then they still, you know, as a parent, you feel you should be able to do things that are adult related. But when you do those in the same household where your kids are, then that's what the kids see and that's what they model. That's the behavior they model.
No, absolutely. There's no question about it. And from what I'm seeing, now I'm a very spiritual person. I'm not necessarily a religious person. But what I've seen that completely makes me step back is that they're taking God out of the schools, they're taking God out of government, and every time you turn around, they're saying there's something wrong with anybody who believes in God. And that's not a great message to give to kids.
Oh, I completely agree with you on that. Not only do you really need God every step of the way, but then you also need to be able to have some of the, you know, as we say, old school kind of parenting. So not only did my parents watch me, but the neighbors watched me and kept up with me and told if I was doing something that they thought was inappropriate. That doesn't happen today.
No.
Parents don't have that kind of support.
No, you could get sued. I wish that was a joke, but it's not. I happen to be Jewish, and I remember going to school. We celebrated Christmas. We had Christmas trees. We did presents. We sang Christmas carols in school. This is what you did. You know what it was? It was our culture. And I think, Cheryl, the biggest problem that's going on today is the culture is being attacked. And that in and of itself stops us from being who we are and also stops parents from being able to bond and be able to deal with those kids today based on the kids' subculture.
Exactly. And so my recommendation, what I'm suggesting to parents, and not just teenage parents, although teenage years seem to be a lot more difficult to handle, but I think that if you start when your children are young and you build those cultural values, you have those events. For example, when we sit down to have dinner, there are no cell phones. There's no television, you know, and you talk as a family and you talk about issues that are going on. They have that kind of network and that's what they get used to. So by the time they're teenagers, they are prepared. Those are not new rules that you're introducing as a parent.
No, not at all. And as a matter of fact, that's a tradition that I think has gone by the wayside. I remember when I was a kid growing up, every night we sat down to dinner. We had dinner together. We talked about whatever it was there was to be talked about. And I think what's going on is the kids are pulling farther and farther away from home. Parents are beginning to lose their ability to bond with that child and to teach that child. There was a time where it was the parents' responsibility. The kids depended on the parents to be able to guide them through life. Well, it doesn't work that way anymore, and there's got to be something that reverses that trend to bring it back into who we are.
Oh, I completely agree with you on that, Michael. And I think also, again, technology has kind of gotten in the way from the standpoint I've seen. I can't tell you how many times I've been out to dinner and I've seen a parent with a cell phone, either talking on the cell phone across from the dinner table with the child. Child has no interaction with the child, or the parent is texting. And I got to say this, if you spend time with your child as a young child, then when they are teenagers, they will be more inclined to want to spend time with you.
No, absolutely. And that point of there is more to the world than we see. There's always that certain something within us and above us that when we need it, we reach out to it. And the book in and itself, I know, is God-centered, but God-centered is universal. That's for every living creature, no matter how they title themselves. You know, you could be Catholic, you could be Jewish, you could be Hindu, you could be whatever. God-centered, and what that is, it's a truth, and it's the truth that somehow we've gotten away from. And some of the kids are, and some people today, they're blinded.
Oh, they definitely are, and I'm glad you brought that point up. Yes, it is God-centered, but I do believe that it is universal. You know, these are not new truths. You know, these are the things that your parents did, your grandparents did, and if people can, you know, remember that and not panic, then they can actually have a wonderful relationship.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the kids that when they close their mind, you know, life is all about learning lessons. And learning lessons, it doesn't end. There's no part of life that doesn't contain some kind of a lesson. And I really believe if you're alive, when you get up that morning, you're going to learn something.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Thinking you know it all, that's the problem. And I think that's where they are.
Well, that's one of the things that's it's kind of humorous, but it really wasn't funny. You know, I do remember that in our culture, children were seen and not heard. And it, when I raised my own children, I did allow them to speak. Now, sometimes my parents thought, why are they so vocal? And, you know, they're being disrespectful. But we had a specific way that they could talk. They could say pretty much anything as long as it was respectful. No curse words or anything like that, but that gave them an opportunity to speak at home so that they would be comfortable in the world speaking and saying what they needed to say and bringing their points up. And, you know, there are a lot of different methods and messages that I think parents who are really should be the heroes in their children's lives, that's what you need to send out to your children.
Oh, sure. You know, and it's to look up to your parents. That's the way I was brought up. It sounds very much that the way you were brought up. And there's got to be that guidance from someone. And if guidance comes from outside the home, that's where the problems start. And the parents today, the parents are losing so much of that connection with their children. If you chastise your child, if you whack your kid on the butt, which is not going to be anything devastating to that child, but you could get sued for it. You could have your child taken away. I don't know if you've been watching the news lately, but the government is now thinking seriously about taking obese children away from their parents and putting them in foster homes. So this is a very scary time that we live in.
I think that's absolutely ridiculous. You know, not to say that I think that there's a way to handle obesity, but that's not the topic of our discussion. But I do agree with you. I think there's a little too much involvement outside, and there needs to be more inside discussion and grounds, you know, rule setting and that kind of thing.
But what isn't, well, actually, Cheryl, when you think about it, that is our topic of discussion. It's the relationship between the parent and the child, isn't it?
Well, it is. It is. Mm-hmm. I guess what I'm saying is, as far as things like diet, I certainly, you know, spoke to my children about things. If we bought groceries and they ate the things that they liked faster than others and it was gone, then they had to wait until the next week that we bought groceries again. I mean, you know, I think that there are ways to manage the household, but it's a joint effort. You know, I don't believe that you should have children in your house who don't understand how to do chores, because that grows them up as a, you know, that gives them responsibility again.
No, absolutely.
You don't see a lot of that anymore.
When the tagline, you know, the primer for parents, it is not a primer for kids. It is a primer for parents. And I think parents, it's too bad that we don't have classes on how to parent today, because we were taught by our parents who were taught by their parents who were taught by their parents. And now we live in a world that none of that works anymore. So I think books like yours are very critical right now, and the message that you're talking, you're espousing, is critical, and it should be out there and listened to.
Thank you so much, Michael.
I believe that. You know, we live in a world today where, you know, there's so much separation. There's separation there's separation of religions. There's separations of ethnicity. There's separations of gender. And my goodness, there's got to come a time where a lot of this has got to stop, and there's got to be a level playing field.
Not only is there you've got to have a level playing field, but one of the things that you said early on in our conversation, and I agree with that, is there really isn't a lot of difference between an African-American family, a Jewish family. Yeah. I think that, you know, the values, you still want your children to grow up and be healthy and wise and successful. I think everybody wants that for their children. And there is just a different way to get to that point. I think you can do that more successfully than others, and agree that the individual and telling parents that they can't parent their children in the ways that they learned are just absolutely not the way to help parents be the best that they can be.
Yeah, and by the way, I saw something interesting when we talk about the level playing field. My sister's daughter's daughter and she'd be my, I guess, my great niece. Well, whatever. Anyway, yeah, she's blended. She's half Caucasian. She's half African American. And it was very interesting to watch as they moved. My niece's husband is in the service, so they moved to different places and whatever. And it was very interesting to see, based on the school that, and she's, what is she, what, 13 now, I think, something like that. It was interesting to see what happened based on the school that she was in, the neighborhood the school was in, the country that she was in, how differently the child saw the world when she came home.
Really?
Yeah. It was completely different. She had a problem in one of the schools because her mom and dad were, well, her, my sister's daughter remarried. And because, you know, both of her parents were white. In the school that they're in now, there's a level playing field. Nobody cares about what. The school she was in before, she was kind of ousted because the parents were white. So it all depends on time and place and where you're at and the theme of the culture in that particular place. That's why I think so much that, I guess you could say it this way. I'm a former Marine. And if you were, and I've never been to combat, knock on wood, I would have went if I'd have had to, but it was too late for Korea and too early for Nam. But okay. If I'd have had to go to combat, and if somebody was protecting my back, do you think in any way, shape, or form I would look at color? I would look at gender? Absolutely not. So we've got to get to that point whereby that's the kind of feeling and that's the kind of thought. It goes beyond that, because if you get underneath the skin, you get underneath the belief systems, there's not much difference between you, I, or anybody else.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the hogwash of, you know, not saying something to a kid on the block who may be harming himself or herself, you know, I speak out. I say something to the little kid who might be using too many, too
nice
much profanity.
I got it. Yeah,
you know, I might say, listen, you know, why are you talking like that? And people today don't do that. They're afraid to do that.
I hear. Cheryl, we're about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at and the book?
Yes. My website is cgwwbooks.com. And the Trying to Stay Sane While Raising Your Teen can be found on amazon.com. As well as a couple of other online sites. And I look forward to many people buying it and talking about it as much as possible. Thank you so much for having me on your
Wonderful.
Show.
Hey, Cheryl, thank you so much for being here. Good night.
Good night.
So many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. The book is Epigenetics, The Ultimate Mystery of Inheritance. Richard Francis is with us. He's a writer who has a PhD in neurobiology and behavior from Stony Brook University. He's the author of Why Men Won't Ask for Directions. And he is also, he's conducted postdoctoral research at the University of California, Berkeley. Stanford University has published articles in academic journals in the neurosciences, evolution, and the philosophy of science. And again, he's the author of Why Men Won't Ask for Directions and The Seductions of Social Biology, as well as chapters on the marine environments of Mexico, Belize, Brazil, Hawaii, Australia, and that list goes on. And let us say, Richard, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Epigenetics, it's a word that will lose most people. When we are dealing with that word, let's define it, let's lay a base, and then we can move forward. What does that mean?
Sure. Epigenetics is a study of chemical alterations in DNA that don't involve changes in the sequence or genetic code. Now, what makes these epigenetic alterations important is that they alter gene behavior, how active it will be. And what makes them interesting is that they're often driven by the environment, the food we eat, the chemicals to which we're exposed. Even our social environment can have physically alter our genes.
Okay, now, all right, let's do it this way. Let's break it down even farther than that, and then we'll get into examples that we can wrap our arms around. Now, what is a gene? What is a gene?
Well, a gene is a sequence of DNA that codes for a protein. That's simply what a gene is, really.
Okay, and how does it work? What's its actual function? What does it do that I could understand?
Well, a gene is a template for something called a messenger RNA, which is then a template for a protein. So in a way, you could say a gene is an indirect template for a protein.
Okay, so in essence, what happens when, let's say, that I walk into a room and I see somebody who I don't like, and I get this shot of adrenaline, and I get this complete chemical reaction, and I'm defensing out, and I'm making sure that I'm protecting myself against that person. I've just seen them for a millisecond. The reverse of that, I walk in and I see somebody who I recognize, something that I like. I get a dopamine squirt, and all of a sudden I feel good. So are we really saying that based on the chemical reactions in your body, you're going to react and respond to your environment?
Oh, yes. Now, what you're talking about there are short-term changes in gene behavior, which I call garden variety gene regulation. Epigenetics concerns gene regulation over longer periods of time, over days, months, and even a lifetime.
Okay, so but what I'm looking for really is the definition, so we can understand what it is that we have. So basically, the example that I just gave is what we're talking about, but at a very minor scale.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So for dopamine, for example, there is a gene that is largely responsible for coding for dopamine. Now, it responds to certain chemicals in your body, which in turn are respond indirectly, that is, to your environment. So if you perceive threat, or let's say you perceive a lack of threat, then your dopamine levels will rise. Now, okay. If you perceive threat, your adrenaline will rise because of changes in certain cells in your adrenal glands. And in those cells, the gene is turned on in response to that threat that you perceive.
Ah, okay. Now, when we talk about gene regulation over a long period of time, over months, over lifetimes, and beyond. Now, when we say regulation, is that based on environment? Is that based on how we've lived our lives, what we've learned, what we're afraid of, what we're not afraid of? And over a long period of time, do these genes settle into a particular pattern?
Yes. In a word, yes. So the environment affects your genes in the short term as in response to the threat that you described. In the long term, there are physical changes in the DNA, chemical changes, cause certain chemicals become attached, which more or less permanently alter the gene behavior, how active it's going to be when you're in that situation again.
Okay, so that's based on circumstance. So, and please stop me if I'm off base in any way, because I'm not a clinician. I'm listening to what you're saying. So, in essence, what we're saying is based on experience, you're going to have a certain reaction, and you're going to have a certain chemical mixture to help you move through it, good, bad, or indifferent. And over a period of time, if every time you see something or experience something like this happening, you get the same reaction. And then over a longer period of time, this becomes the base of how you react based on what you're presented with.
Yes, that's one way that epigenetic changes occur. A lot of epigenetic events, though, occur in the womb. So let's take the stress reaction. So if you're in the womb, you were exposed to high levels of stress hormones because your mother was under great stress, then your stress response is going to be set at a level, it's going to be triggered more easily. You're going to tend to have a hyperactive stress response.
Okay, so this all starts out, quote unquote, in the womb and moves through your life.
Yes.
And then based on your genetics, and if you have children, it'll transfer then to them. And so whatever we're dealing with, the epigenetics, it's really over a lifetime and a lifetime and a lifetime.
Some epigenetic effects can be transmitted from one generation to another. It can be either a direct form of an inheritance where you inherit the actual epigenetic mark from your parents, or it can be in a more indirect form where it's reconstructed each generation with high fidelity. But it's not as it doesn't have the same kind of fidelity as genetic inheritance does. It's not as precise.
Okay, all right. So the genetic inheritance is obviously lasting longer, and this is okay. So as it defines itself, it defines itself limited to the experience that it's presented with, whereby the genetic experience is something that's long-lasting and solid because that came over a lifetime of the mom and dad.
Right. So I'm kind of using genetic in two different senses.
Yeah.
When we think of genetic inheritance in the traditional sense, we're inheriting the DNA sequence, the genetic code. Now, that's the norm, that's the kind of classical form of genetic inheritance. Now, sometimes you can inherit an epigenetic alteration, that is something that's attached to the gene as well as that sequence.
Okay, now, so let me ask you this. When you're dealing with that, what about, okay, let's do it this way. Let's do it with with an example of someone's actions. How would it actually work, and what does it look like the way it turns out in a human being?
Okay, well, let's take somebody's actions. Most of what I've dealt with in the book concerns things that happen in terms of food, or sometimes in terms of parenting, say. Okay, let's do the parenting. Now, there's been some interesting studies on rats where mother rats, a big part of mother rat parenting is licking their offspring, and this licking stimulation of development of the baby rats. And some mothers lick more than others. The mothers that lick a lot have well-adjusted offspring who have a normal stress response. Those that don't lick very much have a stressed offspring, or generally stressed out for life. Now, this effect, the stressed out offspring from the poor licking mothers tend to be poor licking mothers themselves and produce stressed out offspring in this kind of vicious cycle. Now, they've done, the same people who did that rat study looked at the effects of a neglect, parental neglect in humans, and they found the same sorts of epigenetic alterations in these stress-related genes in the children of neglectful parents.
Let me ask you this, Richard. I think it's an important question that, and we've only got a few minutes to go. We're running out of time, but the question is, medically, are there any medical applications that can we take this and use this in some of the common diseases that we run into today?
Yes. Well, cancer is a big area of epigenetic research, and the FDA has just approved 4 new drugs for epigenetic therapy. Now, the heartening thing about that is epigenetic changes are reversible, unlike mutations. So the hope is that with these epigenetic therapies, they can be more precisely targeted to the cancer cells themselves without wiping out all the healthy cells, which is what occurs with radiation or chemotherapy.
All right. There goes the microphone. All right, we're just about out of time. Now, do you have a website we can find you at?
My publisher is upset about the fact that I don't, actually, but you can get the book at any of your local bookstores.
Oh, wonderful. Okay, so the book, again, is The Epigenetics. It is The Ultimate Mystery of Inheritance. It'll be in the local bookstores. It'll be up on our website. So if you missed the name real quick, if you want to go to Amazon or one of those places. Hey, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time. I think the work in and of itself, if people will take a look at what it is that you're doing and what you've written about, could change some lives. And I mean change lives drastically. And by the way, and thank you again so much for your time.
Hey, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay, take care. Good night.
Good night.
I can only give you love that lasts forever, and the promise to be near each time you call, and the only heart I own for you and you alone. That's all, that's all. I can only give you country walks in springtime, and a hand to hold when leaves begin to fall, and a love whose burning light will warm the winter night. That's all, that's all. There are those, I am sure, who have told you they would give you the world. All I have are these arms to enfold you, and a love time can never destroy. If you're wondering what I'm asking in return, dear, you'll be glad to know that my demands are small. Say it's me that you adore, for now and evermore. That's all, that's all.
Welcome back on Michael Ray. And that dumb music wasn't supposed to come on. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night, again, we'll bring you the best and the brightest of the authors and the experts that will have an impact on your world and your life. Our guest is Betty James Loughran. She is a speaker, a philanthropist, a self-made millionaire, and she's co-authored with her daughter the popular book, I Want What She's Got, founded the People Builders and the Millionaire Apprentice Program, and she's committed to guiding others to live vibrant, healthy lives of contribution, meaning, and purpose. And let us say hi. Welcome to the show, Bet.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Owen, thank you so much for being here. I want what she's got. Do you think that that statement has probably been said billions of times over the years by men and women both, and they don't know how to get there?
I am sure of it. And, of course, I know that that little saying came from a movie that somebody had a great idea that it would fit for my book, and I'm very glad that it did because it certainly is an eye-catcher. But, yes, I do believe that people want to get someplace and don't know how to get there, and I didn't either. So, you know, sometimes we have to live our life and learn from our experience and learn from our stupid things that we thought, and all of a sudden we realize, boy, I can be better than this.
No, absolutely. And by the way, you know, you were 65 when you became a millionaire. And that means that if you want to do it, if you'll go beyond, not you, but people in general, if you go beyond what you think you can't do, I think there's where it's critical. What caused you to say, nothing's going to stop me? I want this, and I'm going to go out and get it.
Actually, I was 65 when I started this path that I am on. I was almost 70 when I became a millionaire. I'm 74 now, and yeah. I'll tell you what, I'm healthy and loving life, living to the fullest. I am traveling. I'm speaking all over. I think the biggest thing is that until I, you know, sometimes you have an idea, yes, I could do that, and you take off. It's kind of like a race. You see the beginning, you see the end, and you're headed for that goal. I didn't see the end. I got started doing what I'm doing because I had a health need, and I really just, I was losing my brain power. I had a brain fog, a severe brain fog, and so I was looking for an answer to that, and once I started the path looking for the nutrition that I needed, I ended up making some money, and then I ended up making more money, and pretty soon, after about a year and a half, somebody said, what's your goal for your income? And I said, I so far exceeded my goal. I mean, I couldn't even see as far as where I am today. So now, after 9 years with this company, and it's been about 3.5 years since I became a millionaire, I have watched others do it on purpose. And I have learned how to do it on purpose. That's why I now have a millionaire apprenticeship program. But you know, I had to learn how to do it because it just didn't come natural to me.
Oh, by the way, most things don't come natural to people. Most things are learned. And whatever you do in life, life turns out to be a strategy. Sometimes you walk into it accidentally and you realize it and you see it. But most of the time, you truly don't. There's that old adage about thinking outside the box. And if you really want to define that, we pretty much all think the same way. And we mix it up and it comes out a little bit different. But thinking outside the box bet means thinking thoughts you didn't think you could think. And when you mentioned early on, you know, people,
exactly,
they get scared. They can't do it. And it's just stepping outside yourself. That doesn't mean you have to be different. You don't have to change. You don't have to become anybody but who you are. But it's just a shift in thinking.
But sometimes we need to get over the obstacles that are keeping us thinking inside the box. And one of them is something that you started this out with, had to do with the stupid things people think. And I'm on a one-person campaign to bust that to pieces. I believed when I entered into my 60s that it was time to die because my parents died in their late 60s. And since I have been speaking in a lot of places recently, I've been kind of doing my own personal poll saying, how many of you feel like you're going to die when you're the same age your parents died? And usually there'll be a quarter to a third of the audience that will raise their hands. Now, why would we think something like that? How genetic are most of the diseases that we have today that are taking people's lives? I mean, cancer is now 1 in 3. What was it 50 years ago? You know, the logic of the whole thing about dying at the same age as your parents died is just isn't there.
I think there's a loyalty thing that goes on with that. It's having respect enough for them not to live as long as they did. I know how silly that sounds, but that's in a lot of people's mind. You get you when I say you in the general sense of the word, you sit, you listen to radio, you watch television, you hear some thoughts, and you believe those things. You know, we've hit such messages in the media anymore that people are running around like automatons. You tell me how to be, and that's how I'm going to be, because that's why I think, though that's what I think will cause me to be accepted with the people that I know. And I think that in and of itself is scary. If you don't have acceptance, if you don't have identity, then, quote unquote, you have nothing in a lot of minds out there.
Yep. I think that's right. But anyway, so it was once I broke through from that, broke away from that thinking, then I had to look at my life and say, well, if I'm going to live, what am I about? Because I've always been a very purpose-driven person, but all of a sudden my purpose was to die. And that was not acceptable at all. So now I have to say, what around me is worth running after, giving the rest of my life to make an impact on my world? And I was already in this company, and I began to learn what I was delivering with what I'm selling or what my products are. How am I helping change the world with these products? And that made a big difference in how I approached my business. But I was just kind of floating along.
Well, okay. Well, let's go to the base of this. What's the product?
This is a health and nutrition company that I'm in, Isogenix, and it is a life changing kind of.
Okay, but Bette, what's in?
System.
I know the company is there, but what is it that you produce that is life changing and altering?
Life changing, first of all, is trying to get people into a healthy body again. We're eating so much junk and being assaulted by so many toxins and so many things that cause our life to kind of drain away, part of our brain fog, part of our energy loss. So much of what's going on that we think is sickness is really nothing more than an overload of everything either that we're breathing, eating, or drinking. And you can change your future by changing to a healthy lifestyle.
Well, let me hold you up for a minute, because I think this is critically important. You said that you had a disease. You could have died, and you found something and it had to do with nutrition. You got into the company. That's all well and good. What is the product? Where do I find the product if it's going to save my life? Tell me about the product.
Okay. I would love to do that. The place you find out about it, first of all, would be to go to www.bette.isogenix.com.
Now, Isogenix is spelled how?
Isamagenix.
Okay, but
Isogenix. Yeah.
Now, specific, what is Isogenix? What is it that I would take, and how does it fix me, quote unquote?
Well, the first way it cleanses, the way it fixes you, is to begin cleansing out toxins and pouring in incredible nutrition with low calorie. So people who are overweight, we have people who have lost over 300 pounds on these products, which is, you know, we think of weight loss as being an issue, but health is the issue.
Sure.
Need to lose weight, that's part of your health.
No, absolutely, there's no question about it. So in the end result, so there's cleansing, there's the proper nutrition, and not dieting, but nutrition. I think there's a major difference
exactly.
Between the two.
These are like superfoods.
So you begin
getting into your body the things, the minerals, the vitamins, just the nutrition that will help build up your immune system, build up your body to be able to resist the things that are assaulting us every day.
So does it come
in? I am healthier. At 74, I am healthier today than I was when I was 60.
Now, by the way, does it come in supplement form? Is it powder form? Do you eat it? Do you drink it?
Part of it's in supplement form. Part of it's in powder. They're great-tasting shakes. The cleanse is a powder that you can reconstitute and make it into a hot drink or a cold drink. It's all very easy, very convenient, very flexible, but very effective. That's the biggest thing, is it works. There's proven results.
I think that's really the key, because when you come down to it, there are certain things that will create health. And I think I talked about this time and again on the air. There's nothing that cures anything. It all has to do with the immune system. You keep that immune system functioning and moving and going, you've got health, you've got anti-aging, you've got everything that everybody ever advertises, because there's disconnects. There's certain things that don't get to that immune system that cause the immune system to work. So with the combination of cleansing, nutrition, it sounds like what you've got is something that will connect everything that needs to be connected to that immune system to make your life and your body work.
Yes. And it's amazing. And so the reason people make money doing this is because, you know, if the guy that builds the better mousetrap is going to get rich. And if you've got something that actually works, people buy it.
Now, do you have associates? Do you have affiliates? What do you have?
I do have associate. It is a network marketing company. So.
Oh, okay. So if somebody wants to get involved, how do we do it?
They can just go to the website that I said. Betty is B-E-T-T-E dot isogenics.com. And they can see,
okay,
there's a little video that pops right up. And if they want to watch it, they can watch it. Or they can just shut it off, read the page. The prices are on the front. Either they can buy it wholesale, they can buy it retail, they can sign up all right from that very landing page, or they can watch videos and find out, what do you think? Is this better? Is this not good for them? You know, all the information is available right there on that page.
Yeah, you've got two key areas at play here. One, obviously, is health and life. The other one is, and I'm going to take you down this road just for a moment. Years and years ago, we had the mom and pop operations, and they were wonderful, and they knew who you were, and they patted you on the back when you came in, and they knew the name of your dog and everything else. Big corporations came in. Mom and pop couldn't keep up with them. Mom and pop went down
exactly
the tubes. Big corporations were doing fine for a while until we went multinational. Big corporations fell into the same capacity as mom and pop. They couldn't compete, so they outsourced. When they outsourced, they started to let people go. Where did people go? They went home to their computer, and the entrepreneur was flourishing. So in today's economy, in today's market, ideas like this are absolutely phenomenal because it does two things. One, it keeps you healthy, and the other thing, it allows you to make an income and not have to depend on whether somebody else's business is going to stay intact or go down in tubes.
That's exactly right.
No, I think it's a great idea. Okay, now, we're just about out of time. Was there a question I should have asked you that I didn't that would have brought information that we, the audience, need to hear up? Critical. We got health and we got income. I mean, what more could you ask for?
I would like you for people also to go to my website, thepeoplebuilders.com. The People Builders. Got to have the in the front or you get somebody else's website. It tells about my Millionaire Apprentice Program. And that has to do with Isogenics as well, but they can just print off the information. If they have a desire to earn a lot of money and learn it with some mentoring, we're offering that. But there's a lot of good information on that website. I also have a book, I Want What She's Got, Secrets of Creating an Outrageous Life, and that is also available on that page. And that's mainly what I needed people to know.
Yeah. No, this is good. No, I think that's great. And by the way, we're out of time, but thank you so much for joining us. I've appreciated your time and everything you're doing. And the other statement is that becoming an entrepreneur, becoming successful, creating purpose, it doesn't necessarily, you don't have to be 20 years old to do it.
Isn't that wonderful?
Oh, absolutely, because in another year, I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell anybody what I'm going to tell you. This is our secret.
I promise I won't.
Another year and a half from now, I'm not going to be in my 60s anymore.
Uh-oh.
That's our secret.
Guess what? This is the best time.
You bet it is.
And Isogenics is something you need to look into because we've got a product.
I definitely will. You'll be hearing from me.
Thank you very much, Michael. I appreciate the interview.
My pleasure. Take care. Good night.
You too. Good night.
Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You wing down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All of my memories are happy tonight. I have had a love of my own. Hallelujah! I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Susan Marshall is back with us. She is the author of How to Grow a Backbone, 10 Strategies for Gaining Power and Influence at Work, creator of the Backbone Institute, talking tonight about, well, I don't know, Susan, I got to say something before we talk about the subject matter.
Well,
how
hello, Michael Ray, please.
You know what? I got up today, and I didn't quite like the way my clothes looked on me, and then I walked over to the telephone to get something, and the results weren't quite as good as I wanted them to be, and then I was going to go out to the car, and I was just, I'm telling you, it was all disappointing and dissatisfying all day long. Was that a segue or what?
So what are you doing about that?
Huh?
What are you doing about that?
Prozac.
Yeah. Wow. I just had that conversation with a woman 20 minutes ago.
Oh, okay. My
how in heaven's name can people take that kind of dissatisfaction, disappointment, and find a constructive way to make change? You and I have talked about this before, and in fact, I think we might even have talked about this particular formula. It's called Beckhardt's Change Formula. People can Google it and look at it on the website, and it's a very long, involved scientific discussion about change. And what I thought I would do today is remind your listeners of this particular formula and then really talk more specifically about how to use it. And the reason I wanted to do this tonight is I have been talking with folks over the last, I don't know, 5 or 6 weeks who really are stuck, they're frazzled, and they just don't know which way to turn. And, of course, every time you turn on the news, every time you look at what's going on in the world, we have become so beaten down. People are tired. And yet there's this yearning to make change. So let's just kind of walk step by step through what this formula says. And, you know, I won't try to describe the formula as it's written up, but we'll talk about each of the items. What this change formula says, in essence, is that change will only happen when the combination of dissatisfaction plus vision plus first steps is greater than inertia. So what it's saying essentially is that if you can combine an articulation of your dissatisfaction with your vision for what you'd like to see with some first steps, and that that combination is greater than the inertia that's keeping you stuck, there's a good chance change can happen.
So
if we pull
saying,
these... Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so we're saying, we're talking value. The value for doing one thing has got to be senior to the value for doing another. If you are stuck
right.
and there is unconscious value in that, you're not going
yes.
to you're not going to get unstuck.
Precisely. That's exactly right. So if we think about how this formula works, most people use elements of it without even thinking about it. So let's start with the big D, dissatisfaction. Most people can say in great detail what they're dissatisfied about. And if we take somebody who's sitting in a job that they hate, but it's paying them something, they're reluctant
sure.
to rock the boat, they don't want to get fired, good heavens, they may never get hired again. So they may in great detail tell you all about the dissatisfaction at work. Their boss is a jerk, the work is, boring, blah, blah, blah. All the stories that they're telling themselves about their particular job that makes them unhappy and dissatisfied. Some of those stories may be completely inaccurate. The boss is not a jerk, but the boss is working on things that this particular individual doesn't know about, isn't interested in, what have you. The work itself is boring. Well, who owns that? If you're in the job and there's more that you could be doing but don't, they're not paying me to do that. All of those kinds of things, right, which you hear, So the dissatisfaction, most people can write chapter and verse. What's wrong? Fewer people, however, can then say, okay, given all of that, that's all the stuff that I don't like, but the vision I see for me in this job, in a different job, as an independent, whatever that is thus. That's hard to do, partly because we're not taught how to do that. Right, we look for something that we think is accessible and doable, and we grab onto it and we stay with it. Sometimes we get better at it, but having that vision of something that would make us really, really happy is difficult. We're not taught how, but more importantly, most of us are afraid to put that out there because we're afraid of how other people are going to judge it. So if I were to say to you, Michael Ray, I'm going to build this Backbone Institute as something that is a national asset, and you might sort of chuckle and go, oh, yeah, that's great. What makes you think you can do that?
Yeah.
When friends look sideways at friends who will start talking about their visions for themselves, the visions tend to dry up. And they're fragile. They're dreams. They're goals. And we're very protective of those. So we might put a couple of, the elements of the vision we see, but it's the rare individual who will be very, very clear on what that vision is for him or herself. Now, in time, obviously, we can help build that out. So the dissatisfaction, again, people are pretty darn good at chapter and verse. The vision, less articulate about that, and fewer people can actually do it. Then once we get to the third piece, the first steps, even when people can describe their dissatisfaction and can articulate a vision that's pretty darn clear, sometimes they haven't clue one what to do next.
Oh, yeah.
And so the formula starts to break down there. And if that is where they get stuck, then overcoming the inertia is going to be next to impossible. Now, what makes up the inertia? Habit, socialization, training, always done it this way, self-definition, whatever. Something, to your point, something in this dissatisfaction is of value. So that becomes the inertia piece.
Okay, but I think the main problem with getting the vision, quote unquote, if you don't know what it looks like, if you
yes.
don't have a base to recognize it, there's the problem. And
yes.
one of the
yes.
two ways to do this, you go out and you find somebody else who's doing something and you model after them and you get a feel of what it's like. The other thing is you imagine what it could look like. I can say to somebody, do you see a red shoe? Somebody's going to say yes. Now, the person who says yes will see the red shoe. Now, the other person may say, No, I don't see that. And then right. you would say, well, can you imagine what a red shoe looks like? Now they got the red shoe. So right. with the vision, right. if you can't see it, imagine what it would look like. And then yes. all of a sudden, you've got something to shoot for.
That's exactly right. And in addition to that, imagine what it looks like. A lot of times what we'll do with people who really can't articulate the vision is to say, okay, think about the ideal you on your ideal day. Most people can access that, can say, okay, well, when I'm really, really proud of myself, my ideal day, you know, I'm up with energy and I'm talking to people and I'm selling this or I'm, you know, doing whatever it is that they do. Most people can start describing that, and in there oftentimes is the nugget of that vision for themselves. And that's, it's really fun to watch because energy levels start going up and people's eyeballs start kind of getting a little bit wider and you see the energy starting to come out of that vision. And then we have to say, okay, that's cool now. Let's talk about first steps. Oh, geez, I have no idea.
Little step.
Baby step. Baby, baby, yeah. baby, baby yeah. step. So I have a very personal story to tell about this whole thing. As I mentioned, I've been working with people on this, well, actually for many, many years, but more focused and using it very, very intentionally over the last 6 or 7 weeks. Because so many people are stuck. I was working with a woman who, this past school year that just recently ended, her son was in eighth grade. He was showing up, leaving her house at, I don't know, 6:30, 6:45 in the morning, showing up at school drunk. Oh, dear. Very dissatisfied with that.
In the eighth grade?
And, pardon me?
In the eighth grade?
Eighth grade. Leaving home, showing up at school drunk. So, you know, stealing vodka or getting vodka from other kids or whatever it was, but showing up drunk at school, not once, not twice, but this had become a pattern. The principal had told her about it. The teachers were telling her about it. She was mortified, didn't know what to do, didn't know how to approach her son, was a busy traveling exec, so, you know, here's the guilt. I'm a bad mother and all this kind of thing. Well, we had to stop and say, well, let's look at the reality of this. Let's walk through what's the dissatisfaction? What is your vision? What are the first steps? So that really helped her use a framework that was very structured and very concrete where she could be, you know, just the facts, ma'am. She could set aside her emotion as we worked through that to get to a place of saying, I can do this. Her inertia was made up of her parental guilt, her busyness in traveling, her inability to picture herself having a very, very difficult conversation with her son. So it was very, very helpful in that respect. My own story, and you know, because we've talked about this in recent weeks, I've really been struggling to write the new book, Of Beauty and Substance, A Backbone Guide for Women. At the same time, I'm creating confidence clinics for women, which will launch at the end of next month. At the same time, completing work with two of the charter school systems that I've been working with in Texas. I have been disappointed in people who have promised that they would do things for me and then didn't, couldn't, wouldn't, what have you. Some of them were helping me just as friends and volunteers. Others, as you know, I have paid money to, and they just never did. So all of that created a situation for me where I was having trouble going to sleep, and then when the alarm would go off in the morning, I would hit the snooze button, snooze, snooze, which created greater dissatisfaction with myself. You slug, you're lazy, what's wrong with you, your time has passed, you missed the opportunity, you missed the boat. Ugly, ugly stuff. So I said, okay, you know what? Time out. Let's work through the change formula. And let's keep it real, real simple. I was dissatisfied with the fact that I couldn't stop hitting the snooze button. So forget all of the other big, you know, the book, the clinics, all these people. I was unhappy because I was hitting the snooze button. And I had created over a period of a couple of months a habit, a very, very bad habit, that was continuing my disappointment in me. Okay, what's my vision? Well, my vision is, you know, first alarm, hit the stop, get up, throw the sheets off, whatever, get in the shower, get energetic, productive, happy, right? Make your lists, whatever. First steps, yeah, great intentions. Intellectually, yeah, hit the button, good. But it wasn't enough to get me over the inertia of the habit I had created of hitting the snooze button. So I had to say, okay, what's another idea? What's the first step? I literally moved the alarm clock across the room. So in order for it to turn off, I had to get out of bed to turn it off.
Good
now,
move.
This is an old trick that's been around forever. And I knew it, but I wasn't going to do it because I was strong enough. I was just going to stop hitting the snooze button.
You know what would have happened if you would have called me and my advice to you would have been very simple. You ready for this?
Yeah.
Get a backbone.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Intellectually, yeah. I got it. So the inertia that I had to overcome in that case was hitting the snooze button. But more than that, taking first steps and getting past, you know, the disappointment in other people, part of my inertia was being raised to be incredibly independent and almost completely self-sufficient. I'll figure it out. I'll handle it. I'll do it. Not enough. It wasn't enough. I literally had to move the alarm clock. So that, it was to me a demonstration of how powerful this particular change formula is, and sometimes how teeny, tiny baby steps are where we need to start.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and we've said this time and again, and I'm going to put this up on the wall. It said, rather be unhappy than unsure. And I think
Yes. That's
really the key. And that's a subliminal that's underneath the conscious that is the driving force. And there are too many people frightened to death. What are they frightened of? Not of the world, of I don't know what it's going to be like to be happy. I don't know what it's going to like to be satisfied. I don't know what it's going to like to be. And if I can cover myself and get 57,000 things going at one time, I accomplish nothing.
Yes. But I'll feel like I'm doing something because I'm ever so busy every single day. And I'm worn out when I go to bed and I get started thinking about all of the things that are confronting me that day. Yeah, that's absolutely true. So what are the baby steps? What are the little things? So move the alarm clock, and then I said, okay, you know what? Okay, so now I'm getting up, but I've got to create a new habit. And when people are working through change, we are literally creating new behaviors. We're creating new habits. So I made a list of things before I went to bed at night so that when I got up and I was, you know, ready to meet the day, I was focused on stuff that were truly priorities. And not frittering away and doing busy, 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 but really not accomplishing what I want to.
Let me jump in because this is appropriate right at this moment. Mm-hmm. There are times when you hide yourself, but there are times when you don't know when to say no. And you can get yourself loaded. And by the time you turn around and look, you've accomplished nothing. The disappointment is going and you haven't said no.
And you've hit on something that's so foundational to so many women, and that is that responsiveness. If somebody asks for help, I respond. Even if it's not going to further what is critically important to me that I've established as work that I want to build, as things that I want to do, but I haven't said no, I haven't disappointed someone else. Again, taking it back to my own sense of independence and self-sufficiency, I love to help people. And yet, in helping people who really don't need it or shouldn't be asking, I set aside my own priorities, thus, to your point, fueling the continued disappointment.
Sure.
Real important.
By the way, sometimes, and this is not necessarily you, sometimes the failure happens to be success. Because I get to prove myself, and I'm not talking about you, I get to prove myself right about myself. And then if somebody will give me the pathway and I can take the quote-unquote baby steps, I can get where I need to be.
Mm-hmm. Funny, isn't it? I mean, it's once you start pulling this apart and looking at what you're doing, it really can get pretty darn humorous if you're in that kind of mood. Most often when you're stuck, you're really not thinking about things in a ha-ha funny way.
No.
So the one last thing I did that I have to say, because it's really silly and it took me back to like kindergarten, first grade, second grade, but I put a chart up on the fridge of my wake-up times. And the two reasons I did that, one, were to prove to myself on a very consistent basis that I can do this, and that the more you do it, competence, confidence, risk-taking, right, the more competent I got at doing it, the more confident I became that the alarm was going to go off and I was just going to get up,
yeah.
Which fuels that sense of agency that says, okay, what's next? I've conquered this. I've done that. What's next? What now can I put together in this change formula to tackle next? And it gets to be fun.
We're starting to run out of time. I'm going to give you two things to think about until next week when you're on, okay? And it's got to be life lessons. Every time you turn around, you have a life lesson. And if you don't realize that you're enrolled in the University of Life, it's a full-time formal school. And each day in this school, you have the opportunity to learn lessons. And you may like the lessons and think they're irrelevant and stupid, but you're going to get them. And this is the big key with most people. They're living 10 minutes behind or 20 minutes ahead. And there is no better than here. Because when you're there, the there becomes here. And you simply obtain another there that again will become here. So why run? You're going to have it any way you look at it.
That's exactly right. And underscoring that particular thought is there is no learning without reflection. People refuse to take the time to ponder life's lessons. They simply roll off your shoulders. They bounce off your tough line. You cannot learn if you will not take the time to reflect.
Let's pick this next statement up next week, and when it really comes down to it, everything that you do, everything that you say, everything that you are, you plan to do it because it proves you're right about yourself. And with that, Susan Marshall, website we can find you at?
www.executiveadvisorllc.com.
Hey, I'm going to go through the life, go through the week with Backbone.
See Love it. Next. Thank you, sir. Good night.
Okay, good night.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris, and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You are listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. He's back, Dr. Mayor Eisenstein, MD. Mayor, one of these days, I get that. It'll fall down. He's the author of Don't Vaccinate Before You Educate and the CEO of Home First Natural Pharmaceuticals. Hey, welcome back.
Hey, Michael. Welcome. You know.
This time I fell on doctor.
Once in a while, even the Food and Drug Administration gets it right. and just a couple of days ago, they announced an advisory, the potential link between proton pump inhibitors, it's like Nexium, Prevacid, Prilosec, Protonix, and fractures. We've only known this for the last 5 years. You know, I think why it's problematic is millions and millions of Americans are taking these drugs. I mean, this is really a frightening problem.
Now, by the way, Mayor, it happens all of the time. A brand new drug comes on the market. You see it all over television. They hit it, and they hit it hard. a year and a half later, if you take this, call our office because people are dying and we can get you money.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, this is a serious problem because, you know, this is one of the things I was most interested in for many, many years, way before I got involved with the HCG, Metabolic Syndrome and Weight Loss Program, because 70 million people every day take some type of acid reduction medication. 70 million. I mean, it's staggering, you know. And we've known there's problems. Even the drug companies say you're not supposed to take it for more than 4 to 6 weeks. You know, and yet people take them forever because they know that once you take them, you become addicted to them.
Oh, sure.
But the exciting thing is that there are alternatives, you know, and there's some real good alternatives, you know. Let me tell you what the very good news is. When the proton pump inhibitors are discontinued, the risks decline 2 or more years after discontinuation, which means you've got to wait 2 years until your risk of hip fractures go down. That's scary. That's a pretty scary thought, you know. And that was when people took the drugs for only 1 year. So it takes 2 years to overcome the side effects of these medications.
But isn't being addicted to a drug part of the marketing program?
Oh, I don't think there's any question about it. I mean, that's their goal. I mean, they did a study a few years ago which showed that they took people who never suffered from acid reflux, heartburn, and they put them on one of these drugs. And within 6 weeks, they tried taking them off, and they weren't able to take them off because they were addicted to the drug. They developed acid reflux and heartburn from the medication themselves.
No question about it. So if they develop this, they get the medication, they develop it, what's the answer? Buy the other medication.
Well, the answer is you got to look to what's causing it in the first place. And we have to start looking at what is it? Is it our diet? Well, it's definitely our diet, but more than the diet, we eat too fast. We don't chew our food carefully. We rush away from the table right after a meal. We eat on the run. We overcook our food, thus destroying the natural enzymes that food contains. And we drink too much liquid with our meals. This is really important. You should be drinking before you eat and after you eat. You shouldn't be drinking a lot of liquid with your meals. Why? You're washing the food into your stomach, partially digested, requiring the stomach to start producing acid in order to digest the food.
So effectively, at the same time, if you're doing that with the way that you're during the meal, are you losing some of the nutrient of the food?
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, you know, you're losing some of the nutrient of the foods because the digestion first starts takes place in the mouth. And you're supposed to chew every bite 20 or 25 times. Now, that's really difficult to do, but most of us chew 2 or 3 times and swallow our food. And it makes no difference what the food is, you know, but our goal is to, really you have to think about this. And I think once you think about it, you start chewing a little bit more, many of the symptoms of acid reflux and indigestion will start going away. Also, it carries another valuable lesson with it, or very benefit, and that is it takes about 20 minutes for the body to realize you've eaten something. And so the slower you eat, the less food you're going to eat because the body's going to know it's full. So if you finish your meal in 5 minutes, your body's going to still think it's hungry. Whereas if you take the same meal and eat it over 20 minutes, the body's going to think that you're going to have satisfied the centers for satisfaction.
Okay, so in essence, if you know what you're doing, your body's going to respond in the most appropriate way. If you don't know what you're doing, out of habit, out of what you've learned over a period of time, the way you're doing it, you may think you're eating the healthiest foods, but if you're not doing the strategy behind the foods that you eat, you could have a tremendous amount of problems.
Exactly. And you know, one of the biggest things that I changed after almost 40 years in practice, I used to take a lunch break from 1 to 2 o'clock in the afternoon, saw patients in the morning, and then saw patients after 2 o'clock. For almost 40 years, I never had more than 5 or 10 minutes for lunch, because by the time you finish your last charts and notes, someone comes a little bit late, you spend a little bit of extra time with someone. And so I decided to make a change about 2 years ago, and went along with everything that I've done, but this may have been the most important change I've made. I take 2 hours for lunch and just extended my evening hours by 1 hour. So I take lunch from 1 to 3 o'clock. I never get 2 hours for lunch, but I almost typically get an hour for lunch, which is more than adequate in order to sit down and enjoy your meal, whatever your meal is going to be, in a leisurely manner.
Okay, and that makes sense. And if it's in a leisurely manner, and I think leisurely is the operative word, you're calm, you're relaxed, you're not causing any contradiction to the way that your body physiologically is going to digest. And I think that's extremely important. But it's that time to sit down and take a breath and eat that way and be intentional, not accidental.
Exactly. And let me, it's not that I have 2 hours for lunch. And most people who are at work will have an hour for lunch. But I here's my recommendation, simple recommendations. Don't take any work with you to lunch. Leave your work at the desk. Don't take any newspapers. Your job at lunch is to sit, relax, and enjoy that meal. And dinner, the same thing. You know, often we have the TV on during, and my wife really complains about this all the time, and she's right. You know, that we don't even see what we eat. I mean, I think these are important lessons, you know, and it clearly is part of the reason why we have such an overweight problem in our society. And I'm just as guilty of that too. I'm not excluding myself from the people who have the problems, you know, but I think it took a long time for me to realize, hey, wait a minute, I've got to slow down a little bit. I kept thinking, oh my God, I'll finish my office work faster, get out faster. Never got out faster. It didn't make any difference. You know, it was, and so that's a big change I've made in my life.
Oh, sure. By the way, did you happen to catch what the government is wanting to do with obese children?
I'm sorry, with what?
With obese children.
Oh, take them away from their parents. Oh, you might not, you know, you're not kidding. You know, well, let me tell you, we could start with the Surgeon General, who's about 100 pounds overweight. We should take her away from her parents, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, this is obscene. You know, well, this just goes along with what happens when a government gets too involved in our daily lives, our light bulbs, everything. I mean, I will vote for any candidate that really wants to minimize the role of government in our lives. I mean, this has become absurd. I mean, the president, what a wonderful guy, never did an honest day work in his life, you know, and he's threatening to take away Social Security benefits. You know, Mr. President, Social Security is not a benefit. Everyone's paid for it. You pay for that. That would be like saying if you have money in a bank, we're going to take away your bank account, you know, benefits. Not a benefit. I mean, unbelievable. I find this absolutely unbelievable.
Well, there's a point in it, though. If you look beyond, let's go to the obesity. If you look beyond the obesity problem, the health problem, okay, well, how many kids you figure probably overweight if they were to do this that would fall in that category? What, 5, 10 million kids?
Oh, the numbers are staggering. Well, he wants the government to take over all these children?
Yeah, but think about this.
I never even thought of it as bad. Oh my God! I mean, this is really frightening.
But think about this. Think about this. You say foster homes. That's not possible. There are not 20, 30 million foster homes out there. So they have to go into government-sponsored homes. And if they're in government-sponsored homes, they're going to be in government-sponsored schools. And do
oh
I have
God.
To say
you are so right. This is frightening. You're absolutely right. I mean, well, I can think of a dictator who had something called the Hitler Youth.
Yeah.
And boy, let me tell you, this is frightening. This is very frightening
absolutely.
What you're saying. Because, I mean, Michael, you're more sinister than I am. You make me look like a puppy.
Yeah, but I've got the tinfoil on, so the Rays don't get me, and they won't call me from the White House.
You know, this is just unreal. I mean, I hate the idea of regulation. Give people the tools, give them the understanding; they'll be able to do well. You know, I mean, it's really scary everything that's going on when it comes to that. You know. I've got to find a quote I have here, if I can find it. It was from Thomas Jefferson, And I'll possibly find it here. I got my computer in front of me, but I got so much stuff on the computer that what happens is I can't find anything anymore. I can't even find an email that you send me because, you know, it's buried among all of the other. But essentially it said, let me see if I can find it, you know, as we talk for one more minute, you know.
Sure.
Let me tell you, that's a scary, scary thought, what you're bringing up here, you know, I don't even want to.
Let's go back to the beginning of the Second World War. Right before the war broke out, Hitler got in and he nationalized the banking industry. He nationalized the educational system. He nationalized, this list goes on. And that's exactly what happened to us. And if you truly look at it, when it comes down to it, there was what was the number I heard? $83 million was already garnered in the coffers for this next election. So while we have the world falling apart, we have people losing their homes, we have people who can't eat, people who can't get jobs, and we've got millions of dollars that are being put in the coffers for the next election. We have billions of dollars that we give to other countries because they don't have enough to live on, where our debts are going sky high and we're not taking care of ourselves. So if you spend it and you separate, take a look at what's going on. You've got a separation now of ethnicity that I haven't seen in years and years and years now. Look what happened with the gay population. Because of the agenda that the president said, yes, good, bad, or indifferent, the problem is now that's another issue where there's separation. And each time we look at it, we get into another issue that's brought to the fore, and there's separation. Now you got people going after each other. We are getting separated in every way, shape, and form, and all of these issues are being used. The gay agenda, it's being used politically. The women's issues being used politically. I mean, this list goes on every time you turn around and look at the difference with what's going on between the Republicans and the Democrats. I give you the vice president, which you can have. I give you the vice president who says, if you're a Republican, I'm not following you. What happened to bipartisanship? So you've got this split that is so horrendous that it's going to come back and bite us.
Yeah, no, I think you're right on point, and it's definitely going to very, very, very scary. You know, I mean, very, very scary. You know, I think it goes back to looking at the founding fathers, and their whole concept was one of looking at the government as having minimal involvement in our life, only there to protect us, but not to protect us, you know, in this manner. I mean, this is frightening. Did you see the cover of Newsweek magazine or so a couple of weeks ago, where they had a copy of the Constitution and it was being shredded, and their statement was, "Is this an obsolete document?" They wanted to vote on that.
Yeah. So my concern more than anything else when we truly take a look at it is that there are so many issues at hand, right, wrong, or indifferent. And it doesn't matter whether you're Republican, you're Democrat, whatever the case may be. There's so many issues at hand, and there's so many media messages, and there's so much blurring between facts, and so much of the news being run over to entertainment. We haven't decided which is which. I give you the Casey Anthony problem that we've had. You saw people running in to get tickets to get in there and see. And it creates apathy, because what happens if you get slammed with it enough? Mayor, you don't want to hear it anymore, and you turn off the radio, and you turn off the television. And then you don't have any activity for those people who are going to stand up and say, "Hey, let's look at what's going on here."
Oh my God! You know, I mean, here we go. I just found it. We have it here. If people let government decide what foods they eat and what medicines they take, their bodies will be in as sick a state as the government.
Yeah. And how many years ago was that?
How appropriate is that? You know, I mean, hundreds of years later, you know, unbelievable, you know. Well, you know, but I have a great, great respect for this country and a great respect for America. And I'm a proud American, you know, I'm not going to take God out of the Pledge of Allegiance like NBC did a couple of weeks ago. Now they apologize. It's the latest thing. you do something that's horrifically bad, and you apologize, and that's the end of it, and then everything's fine. You know what I mean? I think we're going to see some sweeping changes coming in 2012.
Yeah. By the way, Mayor, we're running out of time, and I hope so. The only thing that I did not like that I've seen go on within the last couple of 3 weeks, and I can't remember his name, and it's a sad thing that I can't, but it was all over the television, the congressman who said the stupid Constitution. That one I don't get. Yeah. And with that, website we can find you at?
Homefirst.com. That's HOMEFIRST.com. We have a new website. It's only partially up, but I'm really excited about it. We've simplified it. We still have lots of stuff on it. Homefirst.com.
Wonderful. And Mayor, thank you so much. We'll see you next week.
Oh, thank you. Be well, my dear friend.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye. Good night.
Thank you. Bye.
There are so many fabulous faraway places to see, such as Mexico, Sweden, Hawaii, Japan, and Capri. There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases. Pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Diane Cohen with us, senior attorney with the Goldwater Scharf Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation. She spent more than 10 years as a trial attorney for the City of Chicago's Corporate Counsel's Office, where she represented the Chicago Police and Fire Department, handling a variety of constitutional and civil rights cases. Prior to working for the City of Chicago, she served as legal counsel for the State of Illinois Comptroller and counsel to the United States Senator Charles Grassley on the Senate Judicial Committee. And she began her legal career as an attorney for the U.S. Department of Justice and also worked as an associate in private practice. And let us say, Diane, hi, welcome to the show.
Oh, well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this evening.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Anybody with the last name of Cohen is a special person in my life because that was my mother's maiden name.
Aww.
Yeah, she was a Cohen. And she was from Chicago.
Another good thing. I see you were born in Chicago as well.
Oh, yeah, 1,000 years ago. Well, maybe a couple hundred. Now, let's talk about something. I want to lay a base for where we're going to go tonight. The Goldwater Institute. What is the Goldwater Institute? And then we'll move from there.
Sure. Well, the Goldwater Institute is located in Phoenix, Arizona, and it's an independent government watchdog. And it develops innovative, principled solutions to issues facing the states. And we also enforce constitutionally limited government through litigation, which is what I do. The Institute focuses its work on expanding economic freedom, educational opportunities, and bringing transparency to government. And, of course, the Litigation Center works to protect the rights guaranteed to Americans by the United States Constitution, and we do a lot of work in state court in Arizona to enforce the Arizona Constitution and protect individual rights.
Oh, by the way, you must have a lot of work there because, my goodness, Arizona, yeah.
Well, I think having come from, Illinois, I think the states and municipalities can keep those committed to fighting for liberty very busy.
No, but especially with the border situations, and I won't take us off subject, but especially with the border situations and so on and so forth, and some of the things that go on in Arizona, which I happen to be 5,000% behind, because constitutionally we need to protect the citizens of the United States of America in any way, shape, or form. Well, not necessarily any way, shape, or form, but as long as it's legal and within the purview of those people who have humanity underneath what it is that they're going to accomplish. Now, that said, today, Congress heard the testimony about the Independent Payment Advisory Board. That's the controversial component of President Obama's federal health care law. Let's lay the base and say, what is that and what happened?
Okay, well, the Independent Payment Advisory Board, which I will refer to as IPAB in the conversation just for ease, is one of 150 boards and commissions that was established by Obamacare. IPAB in particular, I think, represents really the arrogance that is Obamacare. It is an unelected board of bureaucrats whose proposals can become law without the approval of Congress and the President. And a board that is insulated from judicial review, meaning you can't take an issue to court if you feel you have been wronged by IPAB, no judicial review, no administrative process, no meaningful congressional oversight. And so we believe, and this is a board that will have control over the medical welfare of seniors and other Americans as well.
Diane, how is that possible? And when I say how is that possible, we are supposed to be living in a country that is a country with the rule of law. We have a constitution. We have something that says that you can't do this. So what is it that allows them to, number one, put it on the table in the first place? And secondly, if this thing gets passed, how can that happen?
Well, I mean, you know, certainly the people who support boards like these, unaccountable boards who, you know, politicians who believe that bureaucrats are better suited to make decisions for individuals, let alone decisions like healthcare decisions. Politicians like that don't have faith in the individual. They have faith in government. And so it's arrogance. Who knows except they think the government knows better. And, of course, you know, we at the Goldwater Institute value the rights of individuals and that, you know, certainly sitting through the hearing today, it was just amazing how, you know, talking about rising costs and how are we going to contain rising costs and fee-for-service is such a problem with Medicare. And, you know, no one kind of stopped and thought, well, maybe government is the problem and maybe individuals, if they were in charge of the purse strings of their own health care, that maybe that would be a way to bring down costs and make health care more competitive. So it's just astounding, really, the arrogance of those who think government does it better.
Now, we're dealing with agendas. Now, who was it that chose the people to represent this particular issue? Who's on the board?
To fill the board or?
Yeah, to fill the board.
Well, the board is supposed to be constituted next fiscal year. In fact, the president could start could already have started appointing members, and he has not done so, to our knowledge, in any event. And so he gets to pick them, the president, and he is supposed to seek the advice and consent of the Senate. But, you know, we have seen this president make recess appointments in the past, bypassing the advice and consent of the Senate. There's no requirement that the members be bipartisan, which is a requirement for nearly every other agency constituted, you know, FCC, FEC, also all the independent commissions. So we'll wait to see what the president does on this. The Secretary of Health and Human Services, who testified today, did not have any information on that.
When we're taking a look at this, what my concern now is more than anything else, that I've watched over a period of time some of the people on these same types of boards and these same types of issues, the people that are chosen are that I sometimes have to step back and take a look at their, you know, you got people who are socialists, they're devout communists. I mean, these aren't just words. You know what goes on some of these boards. And if that is part and parcel of what this board is made up of, we would expect exactly what this board is, and it's being controlled, and it's moving the country in a particular direction. I think this is
I won't even go there, because this board should not exist. I don't care who's on the board. I do not believe government should be making these decisions.
Oh, you'll
a body of unelected, unaccountable bureaucrats should not be making your healthcare decisions. They should not be deciding what kind of care you will or will not receive. So I don't care who's on the board. It shouldn't exist. That is not representative democratic government, and that it should not, that is no place certainly there's no place in our constitutional government.
Okay, let me give it to you another way. And by the way, we are totally on the same page. I couldn't argue what you just said. And there's no way, shape, or form I would. I am a very devout believer in what you just said. So that said, I still believe John Wayne should be president, so that's where I'm at. Okay, now when it comes down to it, if you look at who's on the board, you know the direction that the decisions are going to be made. I think really that's where I was going. And you're right, the board shouldn't be in there in the first place. But the problem, Diane, is the board is there.
Well, you know, that's why the Goldwater Institute is trying to strike it down. And there, you know, the members of Congress can try to repeal it. The president could do something. You know, there, you know, we should certainly keep fighting the good fight to bring this board down. But I just don't believe there is any way to make it right. There's just simply no place for a board of overseers who will pass on the health care decisions that will affect individual lives. It is just absurd, and it is outrageous, and actually quite offensive, frankly, to listen to the congressman today, one in particular, talking about, certainly that the government should be making these decisions, and it is just really offensive. I have faith in the individual. I think we all have faith in seniors and everyone else to make their own decisions better than government ever could.
Yeah, and by the way, and it's taking away from our free market economy and on and on and on. We know all about this. But now, you spoke today with your testimony. Were they listening to you? Did they just let you talk and they were going to do what they were going to do? Or did you get
hurt? Well, I have to say, I'm a trial attorney, and I've taken hundreds of depositions. And why do you take a deposition? To get information, to build your case, to know what the other side's going to say at trial. When I sit down and I depose someone, my job is to get them to talk. And what I saw today was just the congressman, for the most part, talking at us. They had assembled, before them people from various, areas of expertise that were asked to speak about, the topics, of interest and about the Independent Payment Advisory Board. There were panelists for and against it. And I would say that 75% of the time or, some statistic around there was listening to the congressman talk to us. So I was disappointed in that.
Well, talk to you or talk at you, and I think that's really what we're looking at. And one of the biggest problems that we have, Diane, is that somebody in Congress forgot. When I say somebody, not a particular person, but I think we've forgotten who's working for who. And there, I think, in itself lies the major problem.
Well, I think that, anyone, certainly who was involved in the passage of Obamacare to begin with and the way it was done kind of forgot who they were working for.
You mean Pelosi was right when she said, who cares what's in it? You'll find out after we pass it.
Let me tell you about that, because, everyone quotes her. It's all over. You've heard it a million times. You have to pass it before we know what's in it. Well, let me tell you what I learned today as I listened to the Secretary of Health and Human Services. She still doesn't know what's in it.
No.
She was asked a question, a simple question, a question that us at the Goldwater Institute have known since the bill was enacted. There is no judicial review. In fact, the act, the PPACA, the Obamacare, as I'm referring to it, specifically prohibits any decision made by IPAB to go to review by the courts. The secretary was asked, is there judicial review? And she said yes. She turned to her lawyers, who didn't seem to have an answer, and kind of talked amongst themselves, and she said yes. And there, I thought that I heard gasps when she said that. And then she tried to explain what kind of judicial review was available, even though the statute says there is no judicial review. Same with rulemaking. Rulemaking is when administrations, commissions, they invite the public to participate in hearings and comment, and they're given notice about regulations before they're enacted. This board is immune from all of that. But when the secretary was asked about it, she said, oh, no, there'll be rulemaking.
Yeah, but so, see, she can do that. Because she has no consequence.
Passing it has not encouraged the administration to read it.
No. But she can do that because she can do that. Diane, there is no consequence. There is nothing that anybody will do, say, or go against anyone like Pelosi, etc. We've watched it happen. We've listened to what's going on. Nobody listens, and I feel that we've got to that point whereby there is that euphoria that goes on when you're in when you're a political figure for a certain amount of time, where you begin to forget who you are. And when you forget who you are, you can say anything you want, anytime you want it. There's no consequence for it. And if they don't like it, too bad, because she knows that no matter what happens, she's going to get voted back in to her particular office. And that's where the problem lies.
I'm sorry, I lost you right at the end.
Oh, I said that's where the problem lies.
Yeah.
Because,
well,
no
I was just, you know, I just was stunned. I don't know why. I should not be shocked anymore, or certainly naive about it. But to hear the Secretary of Health and Human Services, who is going to be enforcing this law that is affecting every American, and for her to say that she doesn't know answers to questions or she gets them wrong at this point is not acceptable. It's simply not acceptable. And it is, this law is the most sweeping invasion of individual liberty that our nation has seen. And for her not to know what's in it or how it applies is just not acceptable. So she should be held accountable. This administration should be held accountable. If they can't, they don't know what's in the law. It's just shocking.
Okay, but here's the question. What can I, as the average citizen, the constituent, what can I do? How do I stand up? How do I deal with this? Because we can say vote for somebody, etc. That's not going to happen for a while. And before that happens, a lot of these things can be passed. We've gotten into a situation where the government has become so powerful that you don't go up against it. They're going to find a way to step on you. If you run up against the government, they're going to look into your background, and they're going to find something and basically will neutralize any power that you might have. So really the question is, and as an attorney, how do I not necessarily protect myself against this, but how do I go after it? How do I stop it? That's not an easy question.
Oh, well, I do have faith that we can all make a difference. I think that we all need to be participatory and be, you know, learn as much as we can about the issues. We need to vote. This is the greatest country in the world, and we have the power to make a difference, and that goes without, you know, regardless of who is in office. So I have faith. We've seen, an amazing just mobilization of grassroots citizens around this country making a difference in elections, whichever, you know, party you're in. But, you know, we've seen that, and it's a wonderful thing, and that's what, you know, that needs to continue.
By the way, we're running out of time. Website we can find you at, get more information, and follow what you're doing.
Sure. It's GoldwaterInstitute.org. Goldwater Institute is one word, .org.
And Diane Cohen, please don't be a stranger to this microphone. I've really appreciated having you here tonight.
Oh, it was a pleasure, Michael. Have a great evening. Thank you so much for having me.
Good night.
Good night.
The music softly dies, but I hope you're smiling as you're filing out the door. As they say in this biz, that's all there is. There isn't any more. We've shared a moment, and as the moment ends, I got a funny feeling we're parting out.
I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and that, my friends, is a wrap.
You're cheers and laughter will linger after they've torn down these dusty walls. If I had this to do again, and the evening were new again, I would spend it with you again. But now the curtain falls.